expert as.
Once more into the breach, dear friend.
Let's close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. Were you
second
here?
Hour. Yeah.
Another exciting second hour of the episode, or another episode of the second hour?
Yes.
Second hour of the episode.
Yes. That too.
Is this episodic?
Well, you were here, let's say, is this episodic?
I will.
You will hear Jeff say,
is this episodic?
Yeah, we go.
Okay.
Everybody's cool. Heard us say it multiple times, so we have promised correctly.
Hey, there's something interesting going on for those of us who have been watching the economy of the world for a long time. The price of oil, and depends on whether you're talking about Brent or West Texas Intermediary, basically it crept up to around $70 a barrel.
68, 69, 70,
and then it started back down. And the reason it started back down is the reports came in that in the United States, the frackers were fracking.
Not only are they the existing fracking happening, but this is great to drop in there. Texas reports a sharp rise in drilling permits, up 21% year over year.
Mm-hmm.
Not only new drilling, that's important, but the methods for fracking in existing drilled facilities have increased by about 50%.
Actually, Henson, Henson Laboratories or Henson Studios were the ones who invented fracking. I finally figured that out. It was called Frackle Rock.
Frackle Rock?
Frackle Rock.
That's fantastic. Jim Henson will love that,
yeah,
I'm
well,
sure.
He's dead.
Well,
been dead
he
a long
he
time.
Would love that,
okay.
I'm sure.
Anyway, I concluded that the whole issue of fracking came from because they do it in rocks.
Right, right.
And it's frackle, it's to
frackle rock.
Frackle the rocks, and there's a bunch of weird little things they shoot down underground.
Probably don't have hair that is quite as cute as the fraggles.
I don't know. You never can tell. I've never been down there to see what happens when the fraggling of the rock goes in.
Yeah, there could be little creatures doing the work down there. I think it's just a lot of acid, but, you know.
Well, back when I was in college, people were doing a lot of acid.
Yeah. You know, and they looked like rocks a little bit, too.
Yeah, the acid looked a little like rocks, and they had long hair and looked like fraggles.
Yeah.
Anyway, what's interesting about this economically is the United States went through a long period of being subject to the vicissitudes, I like that word, of oil prices that were manipulated by countries somewhere else. And initially, of course, it was the OPEC countries, primarily concentrated in the Arab world. And then later, the big exporter, Russia, got involved in manipulating oil prices.
It's vicissitude.
Vicissitude?
Yeah.
Oh, the vicissitudes. Okay.
Yeah.
The vicissitudes of oil.
Yeah.
The but we have crossed an amazing, this is not the only line we've crossed recently, but we've crossed a line economically to the point where, as we forecast in the past, America is the arbiter of oil prices. In other words, oil prices start up and OPEC has reduced its exports and Russia is cooperating. They're reducing their oil production. And in many cases, by the way, they're reducing it because their equipment's falling apart.
Right. Venezuela is definitely slowing its production, not by choice, but because their National Guard doesn't know how to operate any of the equipment and nobody else is available to work those positions.
And the end result of all of that is that they are kind of out of the business because the difference between usage and production, which OPEC used to dominate, is now being dominated by the United States. We don't have an OPEC here. It's just basically when oil prices get above a certain point, it becomes very, very profitable for frackers to drill more holes and pump more oil.
Right. So just to give you some example of why we're going to see the price of oil continue downward, this year there are 478 rigs operating in Texas. Okay. That's a lot of rigs, and by rigs, what they mean is, in many cases, they mean fields. 478 rigs in Texas versus a year ago on February 9. So February, this was yesterday. A year ago, there were 361. Okay, so those two numbers, 361 a year ago, and the rest of the world was concerned. We're now up to 478. The rest of the world is starting to sweat. Okay.
This early in the winter?
Yeah, early in the winter because they're looking around. It's a cold sweat.
Oh, it's a cold sweat.
The Texas Railroad Commission reports that well completions soared 79% over the year, which is a big deal. That's why we have the difference between 361 and 478. But 963 drilled but uncomplete, or drilling but uncomplete places. We've got 478 open right now. They're working on adding 963. A lot of those are going to fail because the price is going to drop so fast because so many of them are going in at once. The failure isn't that they're not going to find oil. The failure is that they may not be able to get it out of the ground for the price that they put into the ground.
The ability to get the oil out of the ground and sell it profitably in the shale oil area, it varies between about $42 a barrel and about $72 a barrel. And it depends on where it's drilled and a whole series of variables, what pipelines are available to them and how they get it out of there. But the point is that if we have deep water drilling, for instance, offshore deep water drilling, it's actually a little less expensive to get it out of the ground once it's done than it is to get the shale oil out of the ground. But we have this huge variance in shale oil, so that as the price of oil goes up in the world market, wells that are just sitting there that have already been drilled or that are mostly drilled are capable of coming online and producing oil as the price goes up. This will have a tremendous ability to dampen out high prices in oil. And at the same time, if the oil prices start down, those wells shut down. So it has a tendency to keep the oil price from falling too far at the same time.
There's a big deal that's happening right now with China. Liquid natural gas deal. Have you followed this?
Some, I know that they have decided that they're polluting the air entirely too much and they need to fix that.
Right.
And they need liquefied natural gas.
So 3 or 4 years ago, they went to Russia and said, we need to start importing more liquid natural gas from you guys. And so Russia started doing it at premium prices because they could afford to. They could pay the Russians. It's still cheaper than coal. And they don't have to compete on the world stage, but because who else can deliver to China? Russia shares a border with China. They can stick a pipeline down there. It's a very cheap way of doing it, and they're basically the only person in the market. except that there is a deal with China going through right now that's likely to be done this month, where liquid natural gas, you know, those big facilities we've talked about for the last several years popping up on the West Coast, to allow the exporting of liquid natural gas. Before, the only place you could get that was in New Orleans and Houston, which meant that you had to, if you're going to go to China, you had to go down to Panama and a big tanker. And that adds a pretty significant amount of time and expense to getting the liquid natural gas delivered. It's not just that, because the first self-driving tankers are out there. And there's going to be a crew on board for just in cases, but the self-driving tankers tend to be doing better than the ones with a crew. So we've got basically drone ships that will be delivering from the United States liquid natural gas to China in the near future, and that's a big market.
I read the same article that said that there are drone ships coming online that have a crew on board. Anecdotally, from a ship's captain that I know, mm-hmm. he said, ha, there are already container ships out there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the container
with
ships.
Nobody been, on board.
They've been doing that for the past 5 years. It's a lot easier to have autopilot when you're not on a road. This is a big ocean.
And what happens is the ships have a crew on board, a pilot, and so on, until they get clear of the immediate shore area, and then a helicopter comes or a boat comes and takes them off, and they then proceed across the ocean, and as they get close to where they're going to actually dock and unload, again, they put another crew on board.
No, there are some things
where it wants to go.
That they're not doing yet with these drone ships. They're not going through canals, and they're not being piloted anywhere around Somalia, because the Horn of Africa is still a pirate haven, and they'd rather not just give the pirates the ship. Though it might be confusing to the pirates to try to get them to figure out how to steer a ship that's steering itself. That would be kind of funny if the ship just shows up at port with a bunch of pirates on board because they couldn't get it turned around. Oops.
It's certainly an interesting. But so things are stabilizing in certain areas of the economy, and the United States. It's important to recognize, in the light of the fact that we just had a big correction. I had a small correction. And who knows, it could start up again on Monday. But it looks very much like the buyers on Friday determined that the prices were low enough, it's time to get back in.
This is one of the things you can tell at a weekend. It helps us to know how – it's not always accurate, but it's accurate quite a lot. Fridays, when people are afraid, they generally sell because there's a whole weekend of news ahead that they can't react to because the market's closed. So if people are really terrified, they generally sell on a Friday. If people are saying, okay, I'm going to buy on this downturn, they usually buy on the Friday, and that's what we saw. And we've got a caller on 773-1400. Caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, guys, today in the Wall Street, there's an article on the new common withdrawal rate for retirees. I guess for decades it was 4%. Now their records represent are recommending 3%. I know everybody's situation is different, but did you read this and what do you think of that? I'll hang up and listen.
All right. Thanks for the call. Do you want to touch that or you want me to do it?
Well, either one. I've heard the 3%, the 4%, the 5%, and the 6%.
None of them work, and all of them do.
It really boils down to the assumptions that you have to look at inside of the portfolio and with the investor as to what the safe withdrawal rate is.
And anytime somebody says rule of thumb in the same context as market, there's going to be problems. One size does not fit all.
If
it does, it's really uncomfortable for everyone.
Very frankly, if right now you had a 60% S&P 500 stock index fund in your portfolio and 40% in something that was trying to emulate the aggregate bond fund – I would say 3% is probably where you should be looking at doing a safe withdrawal rate. If you have something, and of course this is our stock and trade, if you have something that's a little more sophisticated, then certainly a much higher withdrawal rate. And again, that's up to the individual, and it's up to a lot of things. One of the things that I think is really important to understand is the assumptions when you hear these rule of thumb withdrawal rates is the 60-40 portfolio. Actually, it's 60-35-5, 5% cash, 35% bonds, 60% S&P 500 stocks. Or maybe even if you have to look in the underlying assumptions to the 3% when you see a paper, sometimes it's 50-50. The point is bonds are probably going to lose money. They're going to actually decline in value as they have
over the past 2 years.
The Barclays, Bloomberg Barclays aggregate bond index is down 2.2% or 2.4% so far this year in a month.
Yeah, month and a couple of days.
And that's it with all interest reinvested. And the market is down about the same amount for the period. But when you look at the fact that the average annual rate of return over the last 3 to 5 years in that same bond index has only been 1.4%, when you basically in the first month of this year, it lost 2 years of previous growth, which, right, of course, the stock market didn't do.
Right. And one piece of this is that part of the reason why the stock market went down is because the bond market went down. Usually they're not related in that sense, though sometimes they are. And those sometimes are big events like mm-hmm. this. People are starting to recognize they're a little bit afraid because their bond portfolio is supposed to be the safe one, is going down. And so they're jittery about stocks. So, just keep that in mind. Bonds being safe is a thing that we have learned over the last 37 years, anecdotally, looking at our parents, looking at ourselves, our own portfolios. Bonds are very safe, except if you look back in history, we have these big cycles. And we've been through one half of the cycle for a 37-year period, the lowering interest rate period. As interest rates go up, you got to look back prior to that, to the 30-year period mm-hmm. of dropping of rising interest rates, where you see the bond market, nobody really thought at the end of that period that bonds were safe. They just didn't think of it that way.
Bill Gross is one of the more famous bond managers.
He's and one of the founders of PIMCO.
And he has...
He's not there anymore, but...
He made some interesting comments. When he says something about stocks, it's generally 180 out from reality. So he's very dependable as a stock forecaster.
He says the wrong thing.
If he says the bottom is going to fall out of stocks from here, then go buy some because it's going to go up. But
he absolutely called the bottom of the stock market in 2009 by saying we're going to go down to 3,000. When he said that, we were all right, we're at the bottom of the market.
But on bonds, he's been... And then that's his expertise area, which is why it makes me amazed. It amazes me that people listen to him about stocks. He has said the bull market in bonds is over. We're due for a bear market in bonds with very low to negative returns in bonds going forward for the next decade or more. And I believe he's correct. And that was reinforced by the tax cuts and spending bills that have passed through Congress and are passing through Congress that will – there's no certainty, but there's a very, very high probability that this fiscal action by the Congress will run interest rates up. And as interest rates go up, the value of a bond you hold in your hand goes down. And
which
what's
means
happened,
the withdrawal rate from a bond portfolio has to go down, right, or you're going to see a long-term loss to principal.
But the problem is it is the value in the bonds decrease and the people see losses there. They're not going to reduce their withdrawals. They're probably going to accelerate their withdrawals. So we're headed to quite possibly a bear market in bonds. So the 60-40 portfolio has got 40% of its money losing money. Now, very frankly, the S&P 500 is on right on its trend line right now. It's long-term trend line. And its long-term trend line over decades and decades and decades is it rises about 7% a year. Now, you got to figure some inflation in there. So 4 to 5% a year on the long term is how much a stock portfolio will appreciate. if you're talking about or has appreciated over the last 100 years or so, 150 years, if you're talking about take inflation out and you're talking about the broad U.S. stock market, comfortably you can say a 4 to 5% return. If you're paying any expenses in there, which of course most people do, that reduces it a little bit. So if you're taking out 4% a year, you don't have to have rocket science here to figure out that you're taking out the full value of a equity portfolio, but you've only got 60% of your money in there. And by the way, if you take 60 or 75% times 4%, you get 3%. So
yeah,
now you see where they come up with this number, and it makes sense. Now, that doesn't mean that every portfolio is that way. If the investor is willing to tolerate higher variance in panic sell-offs, bear markets, and has a well-allocated portfolio and a good plan and believes in it, can they effectively, over a long period of time, take out more than 3% a year? And the answer is, historically, yes. Why? Well, because there's a relationship between variance or volatility and rate and long-term rate of return. And the higher your long-term rate of return, the greater your withdrawal rate can be in retirement. So it's a very complex subject. But if you go by rule of thumb, yeah, 3% is probably a good number.
Right. Rules of thumb don't tend to work for everyone. They're designed for very, very specific circumstances. And we've said this for a long time. You've got to figure out your own situation and what the long-term historical returns have been in there. Because really what should be said about all of this, no one knows the correct withdrawal rate for every portfolio. Because if your portfolio is made up of startup stocks, of only stocks that are startups, or 100% in one startup stock, hopefully you're involved in that startup and it's possible that it succeeds and you make a great deal of money, then your withdrawal rate could be 40% and it would work very well. Or it could be zero and the thing will still fail.
Well,
because a lot depends on the underlying investments. If you don't look at that and you just say a good way to withdraw money from the market is fill in the blank, it's kind of it's way too simplistic. So there's a possibility for people out there to take a look at their own situation. Unfortunately, there's not enough education for people to make that decision without help in many cases. You can do it. You've got to get educated. But it's an area that you've got to look at your own risk tolerances, make sure you're very well diversified at the very beginning before you begin making any questions about what's a good withdrawal rate. Because if somebody walks in the door at our office and says, what's the amount I should take out for retirement when I have X amount of money? I'm going to tell them at the beginning, I don't know. I need to know more about you, because it's really nice to be able to publish something somewhere and say, this is the number. But the underlying assumptions are a lot more important than the number that you're quoting.
So the answer to that question is, depending upon how your portfolio is constructed and what your tolerance is for a downturn, your withdrawal rate can vary to considerably higher than 3%. Now, just for whatever it's worth, we use a window, and it depends upon the individual.
Is it from Microsoft?
No.
Not a Microsoft window?
It's the Personal Wealth Coach window.
Oh, okay.
Basically, we look at the expected return of the portfolio. We factor in probable inflation, because people will need to raise their – if we have – higher inflation in the future, people need to raise their withdrawal. So we include that into the factor. And we generally say that if you have a well allocated portfolio and you're reasonably risk tolerant, 4% is still a good number. And I really do understand the reason people are saying that it's going to be less. And if you go out 20 years, I can really thoroughly understand it. But it has to do with the fact that, as I said last hour, the United States economy right now and corporate growth rates are running at higher than sustainable rates. In other words, we're seeing the manufacturing capacity utilization rise with each quarter. In other words, part of the growth that we're seeing in the United States today is we are using more and more and more of our capacity. Well, we can't continue to use more and more and more of our capacity. We're at about 76% right now.
We can break the equipment. It's what we see happening in Russia when they're trying to run at full capacity on their oil production. They're breaking their equipment faster than they can fix it.
And once we get up into the 80s, we start to see constrictions where there's bottlenecks in the system. So we've got a ways to go, and Moody's is estimating another 2 years of fairly high growth. And at that point, we can't keep growing at that speed anymore because we just don't have the capability. We're not having enough kids. Now, there's a change.
We're not having enough kids, and that's not all of it. We've got this baby boom that's bulging right at the end here. They've got some pretty productive years left for the next couple of years. But if you look at the baby boomer generation, they're going to be leaving the workforce sort of en masse in the next 3 to 5 years.
And very frankly, right now, if we were being rational, we would be arranging to accelerate immigration. Keep people here who've been educated.
Now, make it merit-based. That's something Trump is saying, and that's absolutely true. We need to do merit-based. We need to look. Well, we're not going to be bringing people in that are criminals, all that good stuff.
Well, it's not so much. We need, very frankly, we need manual labor in the United States if we're going to keep growing. And there's lots and good. There's a lot of good, hard-working, quality people who'd love to come into the United States. But we
that's
don't
part
want,
of the merit-based.
But we're not doing it.
No criminals.
But we're not doing it. We're consciously reducing, and that's a xenophobic reaction. It's fairly normal. It's going on all over Europe. It's not just the United States. The other thing that we'd be doing at this point, if we really wanted to have good, sustained growth and not pull back to that 3% number, and this is a very unpopular thing to do, it's a statesman's-like thing to do, is we would be paying down the deficit, not running it up at this point. The Congress and the president have chosen. We elected them, so we're responsible for it. They have chosen to accelerate when we're right at the edge, right at near the maximum capacity for acceleration already, to accelerate even more. Now, it's a great economic experiment. We're going to see whether the economists from Friedman to – this is a point where Friedman, Keynes, and all the great economists –
they all agree on this.
All agree that at this point we should be raising taxes and paying off debts, not lowering taxes and increasing spending. So we're going to see, in fact, this is kind of like the Vietnam War.
Yeah, this is. Let me throw this in here. Rand Paul said the entire Republican Party has turned into Keynesians. My response
they
haven't. Even Keynes said don't increase spending and lower taxes at the top of an economy. You've got to pay it back at some point.
At this point, Keynes would be saying what we need to be doing is paying the debt back.
Yeah.
And they've chosen not to. They've chosen to increase the debt. By the way, we had a call. I've asked for any good conservative to call in and explain to me what is so virtuous about increasing the deficit this much, and nobody has. We did have one guy call in and said, "Yeah, but the deficit increase is nothing like Obama did." Wrong now.
It's right on. It is exactly. He did it right in the middle of a recession.
Obama's increase was $558 billion used for stimulus. And that is what got the Republicans angry at him. The Republicans have just done $4 trillion and the president has asked for another $1.5 trillion of stimulus, deficit stimulus to be stuck in the economy. And very frankly, what the Republicans in Congress and the Democrats voted for part of the spending bill too, so they take responsibility too. But it was led by the Republicans. We have Republican-controlled Congress. It's very simple. They've said, let's add an additional $3 or $4 trillion and maybe $5.5 trillion to the deficit that wasn't going to be there before, and let's run the deficit up to the highest level beyond what anybody can imagine, and see how that works.
Right, and that's a problem. I mean, it's a for short term, by the way. And people that have listened to us very long realistically speaking, short term, we're about to have some really amazing stuff happen in the economy. There's going to be a lot of money moving around. That means that new investments are going to get made. Wages are going to go up. Prices of things will go up because wages are going up. We're going to see some inflation, but we're also going to see a lot of new businesses and a lot of businesses that already exist innovating and creating new things. But they're not going to be basing it on what's available being worthwhile in a downturn in the economy. They'll be basing it on when everybody wants luxuries, this is what they buy. And what you find, it's very fascinating. It should be common sense, but it's not something that people talk about very often. Luxury items are the first things that people stop buying when the economy turns bad. And when we have a lot of money, the niche market area for luxury items balloons out into much bigger than a niche market item. It becomes a mainstream market item. All you have to do is look at what happened to Whole Foods through the recession, or look what happened to Target versus Walmart in the recession.
Target,
yes, because, well, Target, you wouldn't normally say this is a luxury item. It does tend to be a more expensive, higher quality item than the typical expense or quality at Walmart. And what happened during the recession is Target got beat up and Walmart's earnings really went up. We're building an economy with this excess money that long term is not sustainable. That's what we say at higher than sustainable rates. If you get into a new business and you say, I'm going to make yachts for a living, that may be a fantastic decision. But you're also going to need to make some understandings with yourself to know that in downturns in the economy, people don't buy yachts.
What?
Yeah, I know. It's kind of one of those strange items. Even rich people in downturns in the economy, they look around and they go, well, I think I'll do with the three yachts I already have.
I could go back and look at the ups and downs in the economy through my entire life and never see a bit of change in my yacht buy.
Yeah. How many yachts did you buy in the last recession?
Not.
Oh, see, that tells you you didn't buy any yachts in the last recession. It's a normal pattern.
During the bull market, I didn't buy any yachts either. So.
Anyway, that's the point is that when we get a lot of money that's just pumped into the economy without growth in the value creation, when we have money that we were paying in taxes that's just suddenly back in our pockets, that's a great thing. It's a wonderful feeling. And if you sock it away, you invest it, you use it to do things that are going to create value in down economies. If you increase your business in a way that says, even when the economy gets rough, we've got good reserves and we've got parts of the business that will be maintained and profitable through a down economy, then that's the proper use of the money in the next few years. Pay down your debts, build some reserves. If you're going to invest in things that long-term are going to do well, because it's going to be – this is a prediction – I know. Hold on to your seats for a minute. It's going to be easy to get a good return in the market in these sorts of conditions for the near future. It's going to cause people to think that they're really good at money management because there's a lot of money that's free and able to flow into anything. The problem comes when that money's not easy and free anymore. And then you figure out which companies are the real good ones and which companies are the real bad ones based on what their profits are in the down market. So keep that in mind. We are definitely saying that for the near term future, things are going to look great, but we're making some decisions that on a national level that we've got to recognize that they're going to come with their costs. And those costs, if we're not prepared for them, we should all be prepared for them. We can look ahead and say, spend more, tax less, deficit's going to go up. At some point, the government, some party or another, is going to come in and say, hey, we can't afford this anymore. And when they do, taxes are going to go up. Spending is going to get cut. If you're dependent on the easy money from the government at that point, you're going to be in trouble. Just keep that in mind. You've got plenty of time to prepare. We're looking ahead right now. But if you don't prepare, I mean, don't use this good time to prepare yourself for the bad time. You're going to regret it.
If you don't.
If you don't. Yeah. If you don't, you will regret it.
Speaking of time.
Yes. We've got to play some commercials. So if you would like to call us in here and join in our conversation, the phone number to call in here is 254-773-1400. This is the Personal Wealth Coach with
Jeff
and Jake McClure.
See, we but still you have to figure you, that you out. You should say Jake and?
Right, that's what I did. I said Jake and you said Jeff. And then
yeah, but you asked me to say Jeff first.
When?
Just now.
No. No, we can listen to it.
All right.
This is Jake and
Jeff.
Yeah, McClure. Yeah, okay.
Well, I got it backwards. That's right.
Our names are difficult, folks. We've been practicing this our entire lives, and we're still not very good
at it. This is the Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure.
There we go.
We have to do that. You know, you have to use your radio voice when you do
No, okay. All right. So we'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure.
We said it right that time.
We did.
It's amazing.
Well, we just have to use our radio voices, and that way we can do it. Hey,
any voice we use on the radio is kind of by definition a radio voice.
I don't know. I mean, I have a special voice that I use for the radio. See that one right there? That's do you hear this one right here?
Where do you store that when you're not using it?
I store it in the back of my head.
All right.
Considering the size of my head, that works really well. Hey, there's an interesting thing going on, which should make people happy, but at least some of the conservatives that I know would be really happy about this. The renminbi, which is the Chinese currency, has risen in the last year 5.6% against the dollar.
Yeah.
Now, you remember the President Trump, when he's running for office, called China a currency manipulator, and he's not called him since. And the reason is
they haven't been manipulating the currency for about a decade. That's why
the dollar has been falling in value against the currencies around the world, and it's accelerated as it looks like we're going to have more inflation. Inflation, by the way, means the dollar becomes worth less, and as a result, the dollar will tend to fall in value against other currencies. But in the past, distant past. But over a decade ago, China would lock its currency to the dollar. So as the dollar fell, the renminbi would fall so that they could maintain a price advantage when exporting to the United States. Well, they stopped doing that some time ago. But the price, and this is the really interesting thing about economics, at least to me, and I think Jake loves it too. As the price of the dollar and the renminbi move, and the renminbi moves up against the dollar, Chinese goods become more expensive in the United States, which theoretically would cause us to buy more American stuff, but in fact it doesn't, because we don't have enough labor force to make more stuff that's right. made in China.
And a quick example is that we don't make transistors in the United States.
If you have a 5.6% increase in the cost of Chinese stuff that we purchase, we just pay 5.6% more in dollars. And since the things being exported from China are so integral to so many things that we have, that causes the I word to pop up, inflation, which means that the same thing that you bought from China a year ago, if you were to go back and do a survey, and some economists have, of all the things that we buy and the parts that, for instance, Dell gets from China as their contracts renew, the price is going up for the things that come out of China, which means that the prices of things in the United States go up. Either profit margins go down or the price has to go up. That, in turn, generates higher prices to buy things in the United States, which, again, is what we call inflation. And it's one of those things where you say, man, if we could just get the Chinese, if we could get the dollar down to where we could export more, which we did last year, and apparently Secretary Mnuchin was completely behind it because he supported it verbally at the Davos conference. So the dollar's falling. It's good for exports, but this is what's really strange. Last year, we broke all previous records for a trade imbalance. The the trade imbalance increased 12% last year. We actually, but it wasn't because we weren't exporting more.
No, in fact, we broke records for exporting more. We just imported a lot more but, than we exported more.
But here in the United States, we're having such a good economy that people have more money to spend, and we want to buy more stuff than can be made in the United States, which means we need to buy it from someplace else. And a lot of it we bought from China, and China is making better quality stuff. And so we bought a lot of stuff from China, which makes people unhappy.
When we say better quality stuff, we're not saying in a part-to-part with the United States, they make better. What we're saying is that
the Chinese quality is improving.
Their quality, their internal quality for the things that they're creating is going up because their economy has improved, which means their labor prices have come up. If their quality doesn't go up with it, then we go buy stuff from Thailand and Vietnam and the Philippines and so on.
So it's kind of one of those strange things. By forcing the dollar down to increase our ability to export stuff, we raise the price of goods and services we get out of China, increasing inflation, and we don't. This is the big takeaway, I think. Americans, as the price has gone up for goods coming out of China, have increased their purchases of things from China, not decreased. And no matter what you try to do at the macroeconomic level, at the government level, or jawboning the dollar one way or the other, the fact is, people in the United States, we are relatively well off compared with the rest of the world. And we buy things. And we like to buy things. You know, we bought in our house this year, we bought a new flat screen TV. And it was made by LG. And a lot of the parts that were made by that are in that thing are, say, made in China on them. And we look at all the stuff that we have in the made in China stuff. And why did we do that? Because we had a good year economically last year. We had more cash flow. And we needed a new TV, so we got a TV, and
I think
sure
it's
enough,
funny.
That's where it came from.
We use the word, I needed a new television.
Well,
need has changed a little bit.
It certainly has, and it's going to continue to change. We're also following the other side of the equation, and we're doing what relatively well-off Americans are doing across the board. And as we see the increases in cash flow, we initially did some purchasing. And now we're doing saving, and we're increasing our savings. And this, by the way, is going on across the country. One of the reasons that the tax cut is not forecast to give as big a boost to the economy as a lot of people have forecast, or certainly not as much as the administration wanted, is the majority of the tax cut, about 90% of the tax cut, the benefit goes to people who make couples who make over $200,000 a year. Those couples, when they get we bought one flat screen TV. That's it. We're not going to buy another one.
You don't need one in every room?
Don't need one in every room. Don't want one in every room.
You need three in your bathroom.
We don't. And the end result is that people who have higher net worths and higher incomes, who are getting the majority of the benefits from the tax cut, are far more likely to save the money than they are to spend it, which means it won't give a big kick in the butt in the economy. Now, what will give a kick in the butt in the economy is the Section 179 changes, where businesses can immediately expense things that they buy this year.
All right. So that throws in new report from the NFIB, which is small business folks.
National Federation of Independent Businesses.
That's correct.
Yes.
Well done. Small businesses plan to increase compensation for their employees.
Mm-hmm.
They're planning for it is the highest level that has been planned for in a 30-year period. The survey says, what are you planning on doing this year? And people are saying, we're going to increase wages. Well, this talks again to that inflation. One other thing that's a big part of that wages growth is that the same folks released another thing, small business confidence surges, worker shortage and wage pressure intensify. That means that the hunt for qualified workers is getting to the point where they have to raise wages. We've run out of workers that are qualified to do the jobs, which means what you'll see, and this is interesting when we look at the numbers, we're seeing wages go up extremely fast right now for supervisory employees. And this is kind of funny when you think, well, then all the supervisors are getting raises and the mainstream folks aren't. Well, here's the deal. people that used to be mainstream are now supervisory because they've got to hire people that are not qualified for the job, which means that the people qualified for the job have to do their old job and train someone new to do it, which means wages go up at the same time that you see a drop in productivity because that person's now working two jobs. They've got to give the job, some of the work that they were doing before, to somebody that has no idea what to do with it. And anybody that's ever had kids and asked them to do the dishes, you know, it's a lot faster to do the dishes yourself, but you got to train the kid to do it, which means productivity just dropped.
Nah, you just let them break dishes.
There you go. Just buy new dishes every time. That'll increase the cash flow in the economy. That's a great idea. No, it's not.
Speaking of, you know, we've been talking about the fact that the economy, I don't know if we said this enough, but the economy is in great shape. The every index of leading economic indicators as it comes out, and some of them come out at different times during the month, are all saying the same thing, and that is the next 6 months to a year, we have a healthy growing economy in front of us. There is no evidence of a recession on the horizon, and bear markets and recessions go together. As a matter of fact, the economic output generally drops before the stock market does, and so economic output is continuing to plow along. An example, we just got, then this is, it takes a little while to get this, where it's a month, obviously a month behind, but December's factory orders were up 1.7% from the previous month. That is the fifth consecutive monthly gain, and that is an amazing thing. Now, orders are a leading economic indicator. And that's not shipments. That's a different thing from factory shipments and what the factory is actually doing. Yeah. They have an order, and it takes 3 to 6 months for them to get the order out the door from a factory and get paid on it. So the economic activity from an order shows up in the future, which is why it's called a leading economic indicator. With a 1.7% in 1 month, and by the way, November was also 1.7%. You go back into July and there was a dip of 3.3%. So what we're seeing is 5 months now we've had positive order growth in factories in the United States. And that was before the new tax laws were passed or anything else. Now, what these factories are likely to do and what they're saying they're going to do at this point is they've seen their orders go up rather dramatically. They have, we talked about this earlier, they've been hiring some people, which is another, when factories and manufacturing starts hiring people, that's a big indicator because it takes quite a while to train them and bring them up to speed. And they're indicating that they are going to be buying a lot of equipment this year. Again, the tax, two big issues. One, they're having trouble finding people qualified to work.
So they've got to get new equipment that requires less workers.
They're even having trouble finding manual labor to work in warehouses and things like that. So what they've got to do, and a tax break just came along that allow them to buy automation so they don't have to hire so many people.
Right.
And which all is, of these are working case, together.
In this case is good because if we don't automate, we will have to import a lot of immigration. A lot of labor has to be imported if we don't automate. So the long-term plan is if immigration doesn't keep up, then we better have a really pretty good robot society or we're going to see our prices for most everything go up.
And that's, by the way, part of why we have a trade imbalance right now is the main robot manufacturers are not in the United States.
Right. They will be. It's happening. We've got a big tax break for it now. It's still being developed here.
I'm saying the people who actually make the robots
right.
are mostly in Asia.
The newest startup robot manufacturers are in the United States, though.
Cool.
So the ones that are making them are in Asia, but the ones that are the newest and best technology are here. That's all good stuff. They're not producing most of the robots yet.
Do they have robots making robots?
They do.
Cool.
If you consider that Tesla, the car, is pretty much a robot, there are a lot more robots involved in the production of a robot car than there are people. And they're an example because they are using some techniques that are not quite profitable yet to do things that in a couple of years will be profitable things to do just because technology is going to continue. They're the bleeding edge of technology. what they're doing is still too expensive, but it will eventually become less expensive because they're doing it.
We're running out of time for this hour, so there's not really time for a telephone call and discussion, but I want to put out another call. Would somebody who has identified themselves as a conservative Republican and who believes they are, please send me an email, jeff@tpwc.com, and explain to me why deficit spending, dramatically increasing the deficit and busting through the budget caps and eliminating the budget caps that we shut the government down in 2011 about. I say we because I was identified as a Republican. Why it's now okay to run what is arguably the spending bills and the tax cut are producing the largest deficit, planned deficit in the history of the United States as a percentage of GDP other than World War II.
It's kind of funny because the Republicans in Congress are making fun of the Libertarian in Congress for this one. When I say, wait a minute, Libertarians aren't the ones that have held this as the strongest thing for so long. It's been the Republicans. What happened?
I've been asking this question, and the only answer that I've gotten so far, well, these are not as big as the ones Obama created.
Except now they are.
Except now they are bigger.
Bigger.
A lot bigger than anything that the Obama administration proposed or created or anybody else has created. They make the whole thing look – and I just like somebody to explain it to me. Jeff@TPWC, somebody, Jeff@TPWC.com. Send me an email. Let me know why it's suddenly a really good idea at this point in history to run the deficits up to a point where no economists that I've been able to find will suggest that it's sustainable.
And we're about out of time. Thank you for listening. If you haven't listened, then no thanks to you. But if you are listening because you're hearing me, then thank you. If you'd like to contact us off the air, we do give investment advice, fiduciary investment advice, and management of portfolios to high net worth folks. If you'd like to call us and talk to a voicemail during the weekend or real live people during the week, the local number is
254-947-1111.
A toll free is 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can email us directly, as he said, jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. Go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. You'll read a lot about us. Until next week, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach.
KTEM, AM, Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood, the best talk in America. News Radio 1400 KTEM.